On this week's 51%, first we'll hear from an engineer and author who says changing the way we learn could help attract girls and women to math and science, and it takes more than just following one's passion.
It's a little better to get to just take a little longer, push yourself a little bit, and also get good at STEM because, man, it just opens so many career doors.
Then we head to Germany to meet a woman who is providing education about the plight of Afghan women and children and is on a mission to help. Plus, a few professors and their robot want to wage war on ticks. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
From the three, you then use one to make 10 ones, and you know why 4 plus minus 1 plus 10 is 14 minus 1, because addition is commutative, right? And so you got 13 tens, and you take away 7, and that leaves 5. Well, 6, actually, but... the idea is the important thing. Now go back to the hundredth place.
As our nation struggles with education reform, poor academic performance in international rankings, and the latest frustration over the Common Core education standards, one educator offers a way to learn more easily and effectively in STEM, or science, technology, engineering, and math. Dr. Barbara Oakley is an engineering professor at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan. She is a fellow of the American Institute of Medical and Biological Engineering and vice president of members for IEEE, Engineering and Medicine and Biology Society. IEEE is the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. Before a life of engineering took hold, though, Oakley served as a radio operator at the South Pole Station in Antarctica, and for several fishing seasons was a Russian translator aboard Soviet trawlers in the Bering Sea, about which she wrote a book. Well, her latest book is A Mind for Numbers, How to Excel at Math and Science, Even If You Flunked Algebra. I asked her why she wrote the book.
I wrote it because I switched. I was a total math phobe, and I flunked math all the way through elementary, middle, and high school. And then when I went into the military, I couldn't afford to go to college. I ended up learning a language. That's why I enlisted. I learned Russian. But I began to see all around me that there were these great jobs, but you needed math. And so all the math that I had been ignoring and sort of discounting and it's never useful actually turned out to be really useful and a real career door opener. And so at age 26, I decided to try and see if I could retool my brain. So when I got out of the military, I switched and began from pretty much ground zero to study engineering. And I ended up a professor of engineering. And if I'd just known then what I know now about how to learn, I could have made it so much easier and less frustrating. And so that's what this book is about, the neuroscience and cognitive psychology, in a really fun way that includes zombies, behind how you really learn effectively in a difficult subject like math or science.
So how do you retool your brain? What are some ways you found that, you know, when you said, if I knew then what I know now?
Well, one thing is I didn't realize this, but, you know, I really liked to study languages. I learned Russian, and I ended up a translator up on Soviet trawlers on the Bering Sea. That was a fun experience. But what I found was that some of the same techniques I used for learning language were also very effective for learning in math. And in fact, this idea of practicing with problems until you become fluent with them, that's not so much emphasized today, but it's actually a key to learning scientific-related subjects very well. And another thing I found is just it turns out, because my research relates to neuroscience, I became fascinated with the brain learns in two completely different ways. And so when you sit down to first focus on a problem, you're using focusing modes, right? But when you get stuck, you actually need to allow your brain to access relaxed modes, resting state modes. I'll call it the diffuse mode. And so you need to step away and actually get your attention off of whatever you're trying to solve in order to allow these other modes to have access and begin working on these kinds of problems. So if you can't solve a problem immediately, it's not because you're stupid. It's because you just need to step back and let other parts of your brain be working in the background. And we're not taught that generally in school.
So is that something like, you know, let's say I'm working on a piece for, you know, a couple hours, and then I just hit what, you know, call it writer's block if we translate into writing, okay? And then I say, you know, I got to step away from this because I'm reading the same sentence 80 times, and I go away for 15, 20 minutes, maybe an hour, and I come back and boom, it flows and I'm done. Is this the same idea of when you're talking about the resting brain?
It is precisely the same idea. It's so exciting because, well, let's take... there was the famous surrealist painter Salvador Dali. He was the original wild and crazy guy. And what Dali used to do to do this same kind of thing that you do of getting your mind off of whatever he's focusing on that he can't solve, he'd sit in a chair with a key in his hand and he'd relax away, relax. And then just as he relaxed so much that the key would fall from his hand, he'd fall, because he'd be falling asleep, the clatter would wake him up, and he'd take these ideas from resting state modes back into the focused mode where he could work and analyze them. So you might think, well, yeah, but what does that have to do with math and science? It turns out that Thomas Edison, the brilliant inventor, used to do exactly the same thing, except he'd sit with ball bearings in his hands. So whether you're a writer or you're a painter or you're an engineer, you have to access some of these same more resting state modes in order to problem solve. And so if you're just sitting to try and figure out a math problem that maybe millions of other people have figured out before, all you need to do is sometimes focus hard to begin with and then step away to allow these other modes work on it.
Okay, let's say I'm working on a math problem and I can't get it, right? So I do what Thomas Edison and Dali have done, and I sit with an object in my hand that will make a loud noise when it hits the ground. And I when it hits the ground, I return to the math problem and I still can't do it.
Sometimes it takes several times and several days to go at something that's really a little more difficult for you. But you would be amazed at how much more progress you make each time. There's no one, you know, instant solution always for everything. But just as with working with a writing project, where the solution may not necessarily appear to you first off, when you take breaks and sort of slowly kind of keep working away, focusing and then relaxing, it begins to come together. What shocks me is most people have something like, 12 to 16 years of formal institutional learning, yet there's almost never a course in there anywhere about how do you learn effectively, even though they're supposed to be learning effectively all the time. So I think it is important for people to begin to learn how to learn, and that's part of what this book is all about. I think part of it is I love the work of cognitive psychologists, and I mean, there's been a great contribution in learning, but part of the issue has also been that many educators involved in learning, they're not really good at math from a practical, professional perspective. They're not practicing mathematicians or engineers. And I think that colors the kind of research that's been done and what's been taught to people about how to learn, because a lot of learning materials relate to how you learn things that aren't in the STEM disciplines. So again, that's why I think it's important for people to know that learning in the STEM disciplines is different, and but yet there's some simple insights that can make it a lot easier.
And is it different within STEM for the genders? Do we all learn the same, no matter our gender?
Well, I think there's for women, there's two challenges. Women, I think, are really smart in that they tend to be attracted to disciplines where the professors are friendlier. And so part of the challenge for women is that women are often in professions that aren't mathematically inclined. And so women are really good and passionate and magnetic professors. And so they attract other women, you know, female students into their professions. And of course, the professions that are more male dominated, you know, maybe you don't quite have that same magnetic passion in some of the STEM professors. And so I think women tend to drift naturally more towards the more magnetic and kind of funner professions like psychology. But that can be difficult. That can create difficulties as you go out into the workplace and you face a marketplace where people really do need some of the skills of STEM. And so you're at a disadvantage if you don't have that kind of training. And the other thing that women, I think, women tend to be, I don't know if it's probably our upbringing, but we're just a little bit less confident in ourselves. And so sometimes what I'll see is a male engineering student, for example, will get a B or a C on tests, and they'll be like, well, yeah, okay, that's just fine. And a female student will get the same grades, but they'll just be sort of devastated, like, you know, I'm just not as good, I should get out of this. And it's like, well, no, you're just as good as most male students, but they sort of have higher expectations of themselves. And so I think they tend to gravitate towards something where they can more easily be the best. And yet that can kind of backfire in the long run as they go out into the workplace.
That's a really interesting point, and I wonder if that doesn't stem, no pun intended, I really don't mean that, if it doesn't stem from the beauty image put upon women in the society, you know, about having to look a certain way and having to be a certain way, and if you fall short, well, it's not good enough. And since that starts relatively young, and hopefully that is changing, but there's still those horrible magazines out there, and there's still those horrible commercials and all of that stuff, and I wonder if that doesn't then subconsciously translate into other aspects of a girl's life.
That's an interesting idea. I think this idea of perfectionism could definitely transfer. Perfectionism actually isn't all bad, but boy, sometimes it's okay to be just okay at a really desirable subject, because gradually, as you keep working at it, you can get better. And it just takes a little longer to get better in the STEM disciplines. And I think people often don't understand that. They kind of think, well, I should be instantly as good as I am in some of the disciplines that can be, frankly, a little easier to understand.
It's important to have a mentor, and it's important to have that person. And mentor can mean many different things to different people. And I wanted to know what you thought of this in terms of math and science.
I think it's profoundly important in every woman's life. And I don't think that everybody needs to become a STEM expert by any stretch of the imagination. But so often I see that women in particular are advised to follow their passions. But what that really means is that you're kind of being slave to your passions. You're following something that's just natural and easy. And why not instead broaden your passions? That's a little bit what university and high school is for, is to learn about new things. And STEM is just a little bit more, it takes more time to get used to. And so if you automatically, what you're passionate about is what you're good at. And it's easy to get good at some things. And so lots of people get good at that, and they're passionate about those things. But that means you're just sort of one of the crowd. It's a little better to get to just take a little longer, push yourself a little bit, and also get good at STEM, because, man, it just opens so many career doors. So I think for women in particular, this is just explosively important.
Dr. Barbara Oakley is an engineering professor at Oakland University in Rochester, Michigan. She has received many awards for her teaching, including the National Science Foundation New Century Scholar Award. Her book is A Mind for Numbers, How to Excel at Math and Science, Even If You Flunked Algebra. We now turn to education of a very different kind and outside the United States. A young Afghan woman living in Germany, Sohrah, is on a mission to help children struggling in Afghanistan by educating children in schools in Germany about the kind of life women and their children in Afghanistan face daily. Falk Steinborn reports from Siegen, Germany.
Sohrah is sitting in front of a dozen boys and girls in a small town in western Germany. Even though the weather is nice outside, they are watching attentively to what she is showing on her laptop. Images of children carrying stones and working hard in a hot and dusty environment. They are the same age as the children Sohrah is meeting with. Most of these kids in Germany don't even know where Afghanistan is and what is going on there. That's why Sohrah is here today.
I went to Afghanistan for the first time in 2010, and I realized how many children are suffering there. They can't even go to school. The point is that they don't have the same kind of life that you and I have. That's why I said to myself, that's not okay. We need to help them.
As Sohrah talks, the kids nod their eyes wide open. She explains why their peers in Afghanistan are in such a difficult situation. Most of them are fatherless, and most of their mothers don't even have any education due to more than 25 years of war. They can hardly earn enough money to get by, let alone send their children to school. This is where Sohrah and her project, Stitching for School and Life, come in.
We are helping them by giving women some craft work that they can finish. They sew nice scarves and t-shirts, for example. I'll show you a few of them in a minute. We are bringing their products to Germany, where we will sell them, and with the proceeds, we can then help the women in Afghanistan.
The idea for the project came to Sohrah when she was back in Afghanistan as a student. That she even went there is anything but logical. 19 years ago, she and her family escaped from the Afghan civil war. In Germany, she had to start from the beginning, learn a new language, and integrate with a culture that was foreign to her. For years, she couldn't even think of going back to Afghanistan. The trauma from her childhood was too deep.
But one day I couldn't stop thinking about it. I just had to go there. It was like a necessity, but also a wish. When I arrived in Afghanistan, I realized what I'd been missing all these years in Germany, my true home. And that's Afghanistan, after all.
After 1 year of studying and working as an intern in Kabul, she asked a woman to sew a scarf for her before she returned to Germany. When she gave 50 euro to the lady, she thanked Sohrah for the donation. But Sohrah explained that she only paid for her work. This was a mind-changing moment for both of them. Sohrah understood that a lot of women have a talent that can help them win back their life.
They learn stitching and knitting as much as they learn cooking and baking. It's passed on by their mothers and grandmothers. That's the way it has to be. It's an everyday chore like cleaning. It is kind of a treasure or talent that they have. Some of them are true artists. They are creative and tailor their own textiles that they embroider later. It's amazing, really.
Nowadays, around 10 widows are already taking part in the project. They sew and embroider scarves as well as dresses, tops and covers for mobile phones. A scarf is sold for 30 euros in fair trade shops and street markets in Sohrah's hometown Siegen in western Germany. Half of the revenue goes back to the women and allows them to survive for half a month. The rest is used for transportation, a paid contact person in Kabul, and to professionalize the project. Sora and her colleagues volunteer their time, and they spend many hours every week. Sometimes their work can be risky. On her second trip to Afghanistan, Sora got in trouble with the police.
There are many things that can go wrong in Afghanistan, especially taking photos and being in public as a woman is taboo. You shouldn't do that. It's not allowed. But I did it for my project and my thesis, which led to me being arrested. But in the end, everything worked out fine.
But even though Sora was released by the authorities, she doesn't know when she'll return to Afghanistan next time and whether she'll travel alone or not. Her experience has made her cautious, and there's plenty to do in Germany anyways. One of the biggest challenges is to find more shops that want to sell the handcrafted textiles. She also wants to create an online shop and better organize the import from Afghanistan. This is a must in order to support the widows and the children in the long run.
Sometimes, when I feel overwhelmed, I do have problems. I start to doubt and to wonder, is it all worth it? Does it really help? But when I talk to others and keep in touch with those in Afghanistan, I quickly see that it's worth it. Then I pick myself up again, get motivated, and forget about all those bad thoughts.
This is Falk Steinborn for DW in Siegen.
We wrap up this week's show by returning to the U.S., to backyards, where parts of the country find unwanted trespassers. There's a new robot that could help you clear your yard of nearly all the ticks. Invented by three professors at Virginia Military Institute, this device could help reduce the risk of tick-borne illness. Kelly Libby has the story.
Meet the Tick Rover. It's a robot that looks like a toy remote-controlled truck. David Livingston is on the team that invented this mini exterminator. He's a professor of electrical and computer engineering at Virginia Military Institute.
We designed it to be robust in the areas with logs and sticks and pine cones and that type of thing so that it won't be stopped by minor obstacles. It'll just, roll over them.
If you hate ticks, you might appreciate what this little four-wheeled machine can do. It's capable of killing most, if not all, of the ticks in a whole backyard. And how do you do that? By giving ticks what they love, our breath. Sullivan and his colleagues have figured out a way to lure the ticks using a tube with holes punched in it that releases carbon dioxide. To the ticks, that CO2 release is essentially a big, glorious, intoxicating human exhalation. The rover then rolls along the tube, picking up the lovesick ticks using something else ticks love, your jeans. The machine is outfitted with what's essentially a denim skirt. The rover drags a piece of fabric behind it, and the ticks crawl on. The fabric is laced with a poison that enters the ticks' bodies through their feet, and they die. So if all goes well in trials, will this mean the end of ticks? Holly Gaff says no.
I don't think we should ever try to eliminate ticks. They're certainly a huge part of the ecosystem.
She's the rover team's tick expert and an associate professor of biological sciences at Old Dominion University.
They do serve as a prey source for a lot of other animals. So if you start saying, well, let's eliminate all ticks, well, you'd eliminate a lot of those birds that may rely on that for a lot of their food source. And so ecologically, it's not a good idea.
But that's the nice thing about the rover. It targets a small area, the area of your yard where ticks live.
We will give them the woods, but we're not giving them our yard. We will give them, the deep woods there, but not the paths along that we want kids to be able to play in.
They're still testing the product, but your honey-do list of leaf blowing, gutter cleaning, and pruning the hedges could very soon include tick roving. I'm Kelly Libby.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1312.